Supreme Court has been busy once again. One of the Supremes had to say, well, it was a divided court, which is not uncommon these days, which has sided with gun control groups and the Obama administration, ruling that the federal government may strictly enforce laws which ban a straw purchaser from buying a gun for somebody else. The justices ruled 5-4 that the law applied to a Virginia man who bought a gun with the intention of transferring it to his uncle in Pennsylvania, even though the uncle is not prohibited from owning firearms. With an explanation, NBC's Pete Williams.
Well, the question was, does the straw purchaser law only kick in if somebody that is buying a gun is buying it for someone who is not legally qualified to have it, or does it apply to any so-called straw purchase? And today, by a 5-4 vote, the Supreme Court said any. What happened here was a policeman, a former policeman, said he thought he could get his uncle in Pennsylvania a discount by showing his former police ID. He went to buy the gun in Virginia and then sold it to his uncle. His uncle paid him for it, and he had to check on the form that he was the actual buyer of the gun. He got convicted, and he challenged the conviction, but today the Supreme Court upheld his conviction and the law. Justice Elena Kagan, who wrote the majority opinion, said that you have to have this law in order to prevent people who aren't legally qualified from getting guns to get them, people with mental health problems or past felony convictions, and that it has to be applied universally, whether somebody is buying a gun for someone who could buy it for themselves or not. You just can't have straw purchases at all, she said. Otherwise, it makes it far too difficult to enforce. Now, the challengers had said the ATF was kind of all over the map on how to enforce this law, but in recent years, the ATF has settled on this no straw purchaser of any kind sort of enforcement policy.
NBC's Pete Williams, as we're talking now with Dr. John Lott of the Crime Prevention Research Center, recognized as one of the genuine experts in the field of gun control. Your thoughts, I'm sure they're negative, but specifically your thoughts, John, about today's Supreme Court ruling.
Right. Well, I guess I was a little disappointed with Pete Williams' description of what happened.
Okay, corrected.
Right. Probably the most important thing that he left out was that basically everything he said was right, but he left out one important thing, and that is when he transferred the gun to his uncle in Pennsylvania, he went to a federally licensed firearms dealer and had the federally licensed firearms dealer go and do all the paperwork and do the background check when he transferred it to him. And so, I mean, the police officer who purchased this gun faced two felonies. One was that he made a false statement when he filled out the form for purchasing a gun, saying that he was not making a straw purchase there. And then the second one, that was making a false statement to the dealer, and that's also a felony because the dealer kept that form. And so he basically faced two felonies that can mean up to 6 years in prison. And the point with regard to the dealer, for example, is whether or not the government is going to be able to trace back the gun to who initially purchased it. And the thing is, this information's with the other federally licensed firearm dealer in Pennsylvania. I mean, if something were to happen, even though this uncle is a law-abiding citizen, I think if you read the law literally, it's hard to go and say that he should have been prohibited. But even if you accept kind of the administration's determination on this, the fact that there is a record, it's just not with the original firearms dealer that the police officer bought the gun from. It doesn't affect the government's ability to go and follow the chain of evidence back for who purchased guns when.
Is this the result of a poorly crafted law?
I don't think any previous administration would have brought this case. They probably wouldn't even brought it even if there wasn't a second federally licensed firearms dealer that the transfer went through. I think the fact that the Obama administration brought this, they just want to make it complicated for people to go and buy guns. You know, that it just creates some confusion on the part of people when they might get in trouble for these things. And these are serious penalties.
They are obviously serious penalties. Does today's ruling clarify things or muddy the waters further?
I personally think they muddy the waters further. There are going to be issues even with gifts now that I think are going to come up from time to time. I mean, in a sense, you could have even classified part of this as a gift because the gun that the police officer sold to his uncle is at below market prices. I mean, he got the gun at a discount because the police officer himself is a federally licensed firearms dealer. And so he was able to purchase the gun at a discount, and so he passed on that discount to his uncle. He could have sold it to him at the market price, for example. So is that discount in the price a gift? If you believe that it's a gift, then this whole notion that gifts are exempted from these types of regulations becomes very clouded.
Well, how could it not be a gift? I mean, that's what it amounted to. I mean, if you get somebody from, something from somebody below the fair market price, the difference,
right.
I'll guarantee you, if we were talking the Internal Revenue Service here, it would be a gift.
It
would darn well be taxable income.
Look, to go and say that the government is going to be consistent on these things is a forlorn hope, I think.
Yes.
But, I mean, I couldn't agree with you more. I mean, I think the way you said it is exactly right. If I give somebody an item at a discount when I don't have to give it to them at a discount, I don't know how you could define that as anything other than a gift. And so that opens up this whole area that the court was saying wasn't at issue.
Well, now, of course, again, we have the three branches of government in operation here,
right.
Legislative, executive, and Anthony Kennedy. Well, I mean, he is pretty much the judicial branch, isn't he?
Right. Well, yeah, I mean, most of these decisions depend upon which way his weather vane is pointing.
He ought to really get, you know, like a 10% bonus. I mean, he is, in effect, the executive branch, and it ought to be worth some kind of extra pay, I would think, even more than John Roberts gets. But suffice it to say, I digress. In terms of recent court rulings, does this go in the same direction or in a different direction from how this court has tended to rule on gun issues of late?
Well, I don't think it gets into Second Amendment type issues at all, or at least it wasn't explicitly brought up. It may have implications for that. Now, I'll give you, again, the decision doesn't discuss this at all, but I'm sure a bright lawyer will figure out a way to go and bring it in. And that is, for example, what level of scrutiny do you need to have in determining whether or not somebody's Second Amendment rights violate? So the way something like the First Amendment goes, if the government were to, let's say, put a tax on newspapers, precedent would say that the government has to show that the purpose of the tax is narrowly tailored, is set up to achieve a specific purpose that they couldn't obtain any other way, and that there's some big benefit to the country from having that. You know, and then the court will say, is it you know, specific enough? Is the benefit large enough? And it goes through this what they call balancing tests. And there's like different levels of what the balancing test could be. In this case, the court essentially didn't even have much of a balancing test. They just said, look, the government says this is important for fighting crime. We don't need to look at any empirical evidence whether or not it actually fights crime. I mean, I wish they had. Because I think the government's case would have fallen down there, too. I mean, you and I have talked about background checks before in the past. Look, here's the theory that they have here, and that is if a criminal uses a gun in the commission of a crime, then they're saying because of background checks, the guns are essentially registered. And you can then go back then and find out who the criminal was that committed the crime. The problem is that when you have kind of something called formally registration, whether it be in Canada or Hawaii or Chicago or Washington, D.C., where we've had these things for decades, you just don't find any crimes that are solved as a result of registration. Canada has had registration of handguns since the 1930s. It had registration of long guns since the late 80s. And what you have then is there was a debate over whether there was one case that they claim might have been solved as a result of registration out of all the crimes over all those decades in Canada. And there's a simple reason for that. One is this notion of taking the gun from the crime scene and tracing it back. One, crime guns are very rarely left at the crime scene. In the few cases that they're left at the crime scene, it's because the criminal's either been killed or seriously wounded, so you're going to find out who he is anyway. And in the few cases where the gun's left there and the criminal's not dead next to the gun, the problem is the gun's not registered to the criminal. And so, you know, either they brought it into the country like Canada illegally or Hawaii illegally. But, you know, so you spend all these resources on trying to go and, you know, follow back the ownership of these guns. You know, they at least have to point to crimes that they've been able to solve with all this money. When I had to do testimony in Hawaii when they were talking about changing their registration law back in 2000. And the Honolulu police chief indicated that at that time they were spending about 50,000 hours a year on registration rules. The police not doing their normal police activities, just filing the papers and keeping track of who the guns were registered. 50,000 hours in a place like Honolulu. That's a lot of hours.
Well, that would be a lot of hours. Yeah, Honolulu is a good-sized city, but by no means huge. And that would, of course, that would tax even a New York City's police department. Are you,
right.
As we go to the break here, are you saying criminals don't obey the law when it comes to gun registration?
Well, that's an interesting idea. I'm not sure I thought about it that way.
We'll be back in just a moment.
Hey, it's Jimmy Fallon. Here's what's happening later on The Tonight Show.
To the Tonight Show at the Universal Orlando Resort. We're on the road. I'm still getting used to the humidity, though, here in Florida. I mean, the humidity, no. It's playing tricks on me, man. My hair is all sorts of messed up. When I got to work today, people were like, hey, what's up, Questlove? I go, the humidity is just... There are some great deals for shoppers here at Universal. I've been walking around. Today at NBA City, I was able to get a Miami Heat World Champs shirt for like $2. Great deal. So good. Keep are giving them away. Last night, the San Antonio Spurs beat the Miami Heat to win the NBA championship. LeBron James scored 31 points, 10 rebounds, had 5 assists in the Heat's loss to the Spurs, while his teammates had a lot of fun out there. Catch the Tonight Show tonight on NBC.
Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show as we talk with Dr. John Lott of the Crime Prevention Research Center at 1-866-50-JIMBO. I noticed another thing that came out in the news today. Gabby Giffords, the gun control activist and former congresswoman, is now saying that gun control is a women's issue and one on which women should lead the way. Your take on that, John Lott?
Most crimes are committed against men. Look, Here's the way I view guns and women. That is, my research indicates to me that women and the elderly benefit the most from having guns for protection, and that is because they're relatively weak physically, and the presence of a gun for them represents a relatively bigger change in their ability to go and defend themselves than it does for men, because you're almost always talking about a male criminal doing the attacking, and when you're talking about a male criminal attacking a female victim, as opposed to a male attacking another male, there's a lot larger strength differential that exists there. And so the presence of a gun represents a much bigger relative change in a woman's ability to go and defend herself than it does for a man.
So in other words, you would agree with her that it is a woman's issue. You
right.
would just disagree with how the issue should come down.
Right. I would say it's a woman's issue. Women benefit more from having guns, and so... hopefully more of them will get weapons for protection,
mm-hmm.
particularly women, minorities who live in high crime urban areas. You have kind of a double whammy when you're talking about the people who are most likely victims of violent crime are those and live in high crime urban areas, particularly minorities, mm-hmm. blacks. And so female blacks, I would argue, are the ones that benefit the most.
I hear a lot of things, of course, in the growing crescendo of campaign 2014. The economy certainly is in there, and Obamacare is in there, and immigration is in there. I have not heard a lot specifically about gun control in this campaign. Granted, we haven't reached the general election campaign level yet, but do you expect that to be a major issue this year?
I do. I mean, you mentioned Gabby Giffords. She's planning on spending a total of $20 million on the election this year. Election-related expenditures by the NRA, which is usually referred to as some type of behemoth, is $20 million a year. So she basically claims that she's going to be matching, or already has the money, to match the NRA's expenditures this year. And then, of course, you have other groups. You have Michael Bloomberg's groups announced that on a yearly basis, from now on, he's going to be spending $50 million a year. And then you have Jim Steyer, whose brother has been involved in the global warming, but the other Steyer brother is planning on spending someplace around maybe $100 million a year on many issues, but one of the principal issues that he's going to be pushing is going to be gun control. So, look, last year, you had a situation where gun control groups outspent kind of those in favor of self-defense with guns by on TV advertising by about 7.4 to 1.
Really? I thought the NRA was this font of unending money regarding loosening restrictions on gun control.
Well,
apparently not, huh?
No. I mean, Ad Age did a detailed analysis where they got the records for advertising from across the country, and they're the ones who came up with the 7.4 to 1 estimate. And my guess is from, you know, Gabby Giffords being much more seriously involved and Steyer being much more seriously involved this year, you're going to see it even more lopsided this year than you saw last year.
In summation, what's on the horizon? Any issues you see coming up that the Supreme Court or maybe legislation in the Congress or maybe a pending executive order? Is there something on the horizon regarding guns and gun control that we should be on the lookout for?
Well, I think the one issue is like that's likely to go to the Supreme Court on guns that will be significant is going to be concealed carry. And that, in part, depends upon what happens in California. There's an appeals court decision in California that struck down California's very restrictive concealed carry. They say you had to provide justification for why you felt threatened in order to obtain a concealed handgun permit. But that was very restrictive. I mean, you go to some place like Los Angeles County and there'd be 200 people. Mm-hmm.